Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. So let's review a little bit where we left off in the last show. We were talking about adjustable rate mortgages. For the first 5 years of a 30-year home mortgage, most of the buyer's monthly payments consist of interest. For adjustable rate mortgages, ARMs they're called, the loans may be structured so that the first 5 years' payments consist only of interest with the variable rate loan thereafter. Since most homes change hands within 5 years, the average buyer who thinks he owns his own home finds on resale that most of, if not all, of the equity still belongs to the lender. If interest rates have gone up in the meantime, home values will drop and the buyer will be locked into higher payments for a less valuable house. If he has taken out a home loan for equity that has subsequently disappeared, he may have to pay the difference on the sale of the home. And if he can't afford that balloon payment, he will be reduced to house serfdom, strapped in a home he can't afford, working to make his payments to the bank. As William Hope Harvey had predicted, workers become wage slaves under these circumstances. The homestead laws that gave settlers their own plot of land have been largely eroded by 150 years of the business cycle, in which bankers have periodically raised interest rates and called in loans, creating successive waves of defaults and foreclosures. For most families, the days of inheriting the family home free and clear are a thing of the past. Some individual homeowners have made out well from the housing boom, but the overall effect has been to put the average family on the hook for a substantially more expensive mortgage than it would have had a decade ago. Again, the real winners, like in all these circumstances, have been the banks. As market commentator Craig Harris explained in a March 2004 article, quote, essentially what has happened is that there was a sort of stealth transfer of net worth from the public to the banks to help save the system. The public took on the risk, went further into debt, spent a lot of money, and the banks' new properties have appreciated substantially. They created the money and lent it to you. You spent the money to prop up the economy, and now they own the real property, and you're on the hook to pay them back an inflated price for that property. They gave you a better rate, but you paid more for the property, which they now own, until you pay them back. End quote. In continuing, there's the concept of the impending tsunami of subprime mortgage defaults. The larger a pyramid scheme grows, like we were just saying the banks have created, the greater the number of investors and borrowers who need to be brought in to support the pyramid. When the prime market was exhausted, lenders had to resort to riskier subprime market for new borrowers. Risk, like in all things with banks, was offloaded by slicing up these mortgages and selling them to investors as mortgage-backed securities. Securitizing mortgages and selling them to investors was touted as spreading the risk, but the device backfired. It wound up spreading risk like a contagion, infecting investment pools ranging from hedge funds to pension funds to money market funds. In a November 2005 article called Surreal Estate on the San Andreas Fault, Gary North estimated that loans related to the housing market had grown to 80% of bank lending, and that much of this growth was in the subprime market, which had been hooked with arms that were quite risky not only for the borrowers, but for the lenders. North said prophetically, quote, even without a recession, the housing boom will falter because of arms. These time bombs are about to blow, contract by contract. If nothing changes, if short-term rates do not rise, monthly mortgage payments are going to rise by 60% when the readjustment kicks in. Yet buyers are marginal, people who could not qualify for a 30-year mortgage. This will force for sale signs to flower like dandelions in the spring. If you remember the SNL, Saving and Loan Association crisis of the mid-1980s, you have some indication of what is coming. The SNL crisis in Texas put a squeeze on the economy in Texas. Banks got nasty. They stopped making new loans. Yet the SNLs were legally not banks. They were a second capital market. Today, the banks have become SNLs. They have tied their own portfolios to the housing market. I think a squeeze is coming that will affect the entire banking system. The madness of bankers has become unprecedented. Banks will wind up sitting on top of bad loans of all kinds because the American economy is now housing sale driven. End quote. And again, that was back in 2005, and we see that that prediction has come true. The savings and loan industry collapsed after interest rates were raised to unprecedented levels in the 1980s. The commercial bank's prime rate, the rate at which they had to borrow, reached 20.5% at a time when the SNLs were earning only about 5% on mortgage loans made previously, and the negative spread caused them huge losses. When mortgage-backed securities were developed, banks succeeded in offloading mortgages by selling them to investors, but the banks could still be liable in the event of default. The banks were also heavily invested themselves in securities infected with subprime debt. And I'll return to this in a second. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. By January 2007, the housing boom had substantially cooled after a series of interest rate hikes were imposed by the Fed. An article in the New York Times that month warned, quote, 1 in 5 subprime loans will end in foreclosure. About 2.2 million borrowers who took out subprime loans from 1998 to 2006 are likely to lose their homes, end quote. In an editorial the same month, Mike Whitney noted that when family members and other occupants are included, that could mean 10 million people turned out into the streets, and some analysts thought even that estimate was low. Whitney quoted Peter Schiff, president of an investment strategies company, who warned, quote, the secondary effects of the 1 out of 5 subprime default rate will be a chain reaction of rising interest rates and falling home prices, engendering still more defaults, with the added foreclosures causing the cycle to repeat. In my opinion, when the cycle is fully played out, we are more likely to see an 80% default rate rather than 20%. Whitney commented, quote, 40 million Americans headed towards foreclosure? Better pick out a comfy spot in the local park to set up the lean-to. Schiff's calculations may be overly pessimistic, but his reasoning is sound. Once mortgage holders realize that their homes are worth tens of thousands less than the amount of their loan, they are likely to mail in their house keys rather than make additional mortgage payments. As Schiff says, why would anyone stretch to spend 40% of his monthly income to service a $700,000 mortgage on a condo valued at $500,000, especially when there are plenty of comparable rentals that are far more affordable? End quote. As with the crash of 1929, the finger of responsibility was pointed at the Federal Reserve, which blew up the housing bubble with easy credit, then put a pin in it by making credit much harder to get. Whitney writes, quote, the Fed kept the printing presses whirring along at full tilt while the banks and mortgage lenders devised every scam imaginable to put greenbacks into the hands of unqualified borrowers. ARMs, interest-only or no down payment loans, etc., were all part of the creative financing boondoggle, which kept the economy sputtering along after the dot-com crack-up in 2000. Now, many of these same buyers are stuck with enormous loans that are about to reset at drastically higher rates, while their homes have already depreciated 10 to 20% in value. This phenomenon of being shackled to a negative equity mortgage is what economist Michael Hudson calls the new road to serfdom, paying off a mortgage that is significantly larger than the current value of the house. The sheer magnitude of the problem is staggering, end quote. The ability to adjust interest rates is considered a necessary and proper tool of the Fed in managing the money supply, but it is also a form of arbitrary manipulation that can be used to benefit one group over another. The very notion that we have a free market is belied by the fact that investors, advisors, and market analysts wait with bated breath to hear what the Fed is going to do to interest rates from month to month. The market is responding not to supply and demand, but to top-down dictatorial control. That would not be so bad if it actually worked, but a sinking economy can't be kept afloat merely by adjusting interest rates. The problem has been compared to pushing on a string. When issuing more debt is the only way to keep money in the money supply, once borrowers are all borrowed up and lenders have reached their lending limits, no amount of lowering interest rates will get more debt money into the economy. The only solution to this conundrum is to get real money into the system, real, interest-free, debt-free, government-issued legal tender of the sort first devised by the American colonists. And again, I'm going to repeat this. The only solution to this conundrum is to get real money into the system, real, interest-free, debt-free, government-issued legal tender of the sort first devised by the American colonists. As early as 2005, financial weather forecasters could see two economic storm fronts forming on the horizon, and both were being blamed on the market manipulations of the Fed. And we'll take a look at the financial storms. Just like in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, Uncle Henry sat upon the doorstep and looked anxiously at the sky, which was even grayer than usual. "There's a cyclone coming, Em," he called to his wife. Aunt Em dropped her work and came to the door. "Quick, Dorothy," she screamed, "run for the cellar." The rare weather phenomenon known as the perfect storm occurs when two storm fronts collide. What analysts were calling the perfect financial storm was the impending collision of the two economic storm fronts of inflation and deflation. The American money supply was being continually pumped up with new money created as loans, but borrowers were increasingly unable to repay their loans, which were going into default. When loans are extinguished by default, the money supply contracts and deflation and depression result. The collision of these two forces can result in stagflation, price inflation without economic growth. This is a Category 1 financial storm. A Category 5 storm might result from a derivatives crisis in which major traders defaulted on their bets, or from a serious decline in the housing market. In a June 2005 newsletter, Al Martin stated that the General Accounting Office, the Office of the Comptroller of Currency, and the Federal Housing Administration had privately warned that a decline of as much as 40% could occur in the housing market between 2005 and 2010. A housing decline of that magnitude, warned his sources, could collapse the economy of the United States. After a series of changes beginning in 2001, dropping the federal funds rate to unprecedented lows, housing prices began their inexorable climb, aided by a loosening of lending standards. Adjustable rate loans, interest-only loans, and no down payment loans drew many new home buyers into the market, putting steady upward pressure on prices. Soaring housing prices, in turn, deepened the debt crisis. To keep all this new debt money afloat required a steady stream of new borrowers, prompting lenders to offer loans to shaky borrowers on more and more lax conditions. In 2005, a Mortgage Bankers Association survey found that high-risk adjustable and interest-only loans had grown to account for nearly half of new loan applications. Federal Reserve Governor Susan Schmidt-Biess, speaking in October of 2005, said that average U.S. housing prices had appreciated by more than 80% since 1997. Rock-bottom interest rates salvaged stock market speculators and big investment banks from the 2000 recession, and they allowed some politically popular tax cuts that favored big investors. But they were disastrous for the bond market, where retired people have traditionally invested for a safe and predictable return on their savings. And I'll return in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So as I was saying, rock-bottom interest rates salvaged stock market speculators and big investment banks from the 2000 recession. And they allowed some politically popular tax cuts that favored big investors, but they were disastrous for bond market, where retired people have traditionally invested for a safe and predictable return on their savings. By 2004, real returns after inflation on short-term interest rates were negative. That is, if you lent $100 to the government by buying its bonds this year, your investment might grow to be worth $102 next year, but after inflation, it would be worth only $98. The result was to force retired people living on investment income to move out of the reliable bond market and into that much riskier stock market. Today, stocks are owned by over half of Americans, the highest number in history. The Fed's low interest policies also discouraged foreign investors from buying U.S. bonds, and that is what precipitated the second financial storm front. Foreign investment money is relied on by the government to roll over its ballooning debt. New bonds must continually be sold to investors to replace the old bonds as they become due. The Fed was therefore under pressure to raise interest rates, both to attract foreign investors and to keep a lid on inflation. Higher interest rates, though, meant that increasing numbers of homes would go into foreclosure, and when mortgages are voided out, the supply of credit money they created shrinks with them. Although the sellers have been paid and the old loan money is still in the system, the banks have to balance their books, which means they can create less money in the form of new loans, and borrowers are harder to find because higher interest rates are less attractive to them. In the last normal correction of the housing market between 1989 and 1991, median home prices dropped by 17% and 3.6 million mortgages went into default. Analysts estimated that same decline in 2005 will produce 20 million defaults because the average equity to debt ratio, the percentage of a home that is actually owned by the homeowner, had dropped dramatically. The ratio went from 37% in 1990 to a mere 14% in 2005, a record low, because $3 trillion had been taken out of property equities in the previous 4 years to sustain consumer spending. What would 20 million defaults do to the money supply? Al Martin cited a Federal Reserve study reported by Alan Greenspan before the Joint Economic Committee in June 2005, estimating that $2 trillion would simply evaporate along with these uncollectible loans. That meant $2 trillion less to spend on government programs, wages, and salaries. In 2005, $2 trillion was about one-fifth the total M3 money supply. Accompanying that radical contraction, analysts predicted that stocks and home values would plummet, income taxes would triple, Social Security and Medicare benefits would be slashed in half, and pensions and comfortable retirements would become things of the past. And that was assuming housing prices dropped by only 17%. A substantially higher drop was feared, with even more dire consequences. And this was all compounded by Fannie and Freddie with derivatives and mortgage-backed securities. In a June 2002 article titled, "Fannie and Freddie Were Lenders," Richard Freeman warned that the housing bubble was the largest bubble in history, dwarfing anything that had gone before, and that it had been pumped up to its gargantuan size by Fannie Mae, the Federal National Mortgage Association, and Freddie Mac, the Federal Home Mortgage Corporation, twin volcanoes that were about to blow. Fannie and Freddie dramatically expanded the ways money could be created by mortgage lending, allowing the banks to issue many more loans than would otherwise have been possible. But it all added up to another Ponzi scheme, and it was reaching its mathematical limits. Focusing on the larger of these two institutional cousins, Fannie Mae, Freeman noted that if it were a bank, it would be the third largest bank in the world, and that it made enormous amounts of money in the real estate market for its private owners. Contrary to popular belief, Fannie Mae was not actually a government agency. It began that way under Roosevelt's New Deal, but it was later transformed into a totally private corporation. It issued stock that was bought by private investors, and eventually it was listed on the stock exchange. Like the Federal Reserve, it became federal only in name. Before the late 1970s, there were two principal forms of mortgage lending. The lender could issue a mortgage loan and keep it, or the lender could sell the loan to Fannie Mae and use the cash to make a second loan, which could also be sold to Fannie Mae, allowing the bank to make a third loan, and so on. Freeman gave the example of a mortgage lending financial institution that made five successive loans in this way for $150,000 each, all from an initial investment of $150,000. It sold the first four to Fannie Mae, which bought them with money made from the issuance of its own bonds. The lender kept the fifth loan. At the end of the process, the mortgage lending institution still had only one loan for $150,000 on its books, and Fannie Mae had loans totaling $600,000 on its books. In 1978 through 1981, however, policy changes were made that would flood the housing market with even more new money. Fannie Mae gathered its purchased mortgages from different mortgage lending institutions and pooled them together, producing a type of lending vehicle called a mortgage-backed security, an MBS. Fannie Mae, for example, might bundle 1,000 30-year fixed interest mortgages, each worth roughly $100,000, and pool them into a $100 million MBS. It would put a loan guarantee on the MBS, for which it would earn a fee, guaranteeing that in the event of default, it would pay the interest and principal due on the loans fully and in a timely fashion. The MBS would then be sold as securities in denominations of $1,000 or more to outside investors, including mutual funds, pension funds, and insurance companies. The investors would become the owners of the MBS and would have a claim on the underlying principal and interest stream of the mortgage, but if anything went wrong, Fannie Mae was still responsible. The MBS succeeded in extending the sources of funds that could be tapped into for mortgage lending far into U.S. and international financial markets. It also substantially increased Fannie Mae's risk. Then Fannie devised a fourth way of extracting money from the markets. It took the securities and pooled them again, this time into an instrument called a real estate mortgage investment conduit, or REMIC, also known as restructured MBS, or collateralized mortgage obligation. REMICs are very complex derivatives. Freeman wrote, "They are bets sold to institutional investors and individuals to draw money into the housing bubble." Roughly half of Fannie Mae's mortgage-backed securities had been transformed into these highly speculative REMIC derivative instruments. Thus, said Freeman, what started out as a simple home mortgage has been transmogrified into something one would expect to find at a Las Vegas gambling casino. Yet the housing bubble now depends on precisely these instruments as sources of funds. Only the first of these devices was an asset, something on which Fannie Mae could collect a steady stream of principal and interest. The others represented very risky obligations. These investment vehicles fed the housing bubble and fed off it, but at some point, said Freeman, a wave of mortgage defaults was inevitable, and when that happened, the riskier mortgage-related obligations would amplify the crisis. They were particularly risky because they involved leveraging, making multiple investments with borrowed money. That meant that when the bet went wrong, many losses would have to be paid instead of one. And we'll continue looking at these issues in the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.